Okay, welcome. My name is Sam Grauber. I teach at Valparaiso, like Fred. I'm a Lilly Fellow there, so I'm actually only there for 2 years. And I just got done with my first, so it was a lot of fun getting to know the community there. And I've been teaching at Holden for a little while. I was first here in 2006 during winter program for 7 weeks, and now I'm happy to come back in the summertime. And I've also done other things here too, splitting wood last year, which was also really fun. But I've been actually anticipating doing this program since 2007. I was going to be up here for a summer, the week of the fire. And so the last time I was up to do prophetic imagination in American literature, I ended up going to a Vesper service and hearing Tom say, okay, tomorrow morning everybody needs to be on the bus with their luggage, everybody's going to be evacuated except for a skeleton crew of about 20 staff. And so before I ever got a chance to approach this topic, which I'd been thinking about for a while, I was down the mountain. And it maybe was just as well because it's had a little bit more time to percolate. And I think it'll be interesting. Many of you maybe have read Walter Brueggemann's work, The Prophetic Imagination. The new edition looks like this, and there are copies in the bookstore for anybody who hasn't read it. It's a little bit of a theological classic, I think. As you can tell, it's fairly short. Parts of it are dense, and parts of it are not. And so if you're reading it, I think just about anybody can get some value out of this book for how you're going to read not really just prophetic literature, but really the whole Bible, and think about what the Word of God is all about. It really is a kind of a wonderful little book. What we're going to be using this week is a couple of ideas that I think are particularly useful, not just for thinking about biblical writing, but also for thinking about American writing. And I'm going to give you a couple of propositions in just a bit. But just to sort of forecast where we're heading ultimately in this endeavor, I'm going to point you to the little handout that I gave you that starts out with a want ad. And I wish I could say that this was inspired by Fred's notion that every session should begin with a little bit of hilarity. This was actually something that I'd thought of maybe even putting up all around Holden the last time I was here, that we should just have want ads out there for prophets. Partly because I think one of the toughest things in thinking about what prophecy is, and one of the things that Brueggemann is most helpful for, is getting us to open up that category so that we can approach it. Because I think in our minds, we think of prophets as somehow on a mountaintop somewhere, struck by the lightning of God's word, and then sort of broadcasting that out to a divine community. And I think that's useful in some ways. There are certainly prophets who might fit that bill. But one of the things that Brueggemann is up to in this book is kind of cracking that a little bit and starting to think about prophecy as something that we can also potentially participate in. And so I thought the best way to communicate that would maybe be through something as mundane as a want ad. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if somebody just put this in a paper somewhere? Prophetic American writers, wanted, job responsibilities, redeeming language, recovering reality, providing new ways of seeing and feeling about the world, qualifications, imagination required, faith and hope preferred, love encouraged, religious experience not necessary, minions of the status quo need not apply, now hiring. And I think that's actually maybe what we're being called to by God. And I would love to see that in a newspaper someday. But until then, we just have to imagine that it's there, that prophecy is potentially at least something that we can be drawn into. And I know there are a lot of excuses for this, but I just want to point out that all those excuses have been used before. All your reasons for not joining into a prophetic endeavor are actually already in the Bible. Look at all the famous prophets. What's the first thing that they say, right? We've got, you're too ordinary to be a prophet, right, folks? Well, so was Moses, right? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Who am I? I got nothing to bring to the table, God. It's already there. Moses is the prophet, right? The one that all other prophets are going to resemble if they're true prophets. And where does he start? He starts by saying, nope, can do. Right? So, you're going to be reluctant, that's fine, so was Moses. Maybe you're not equipped to be a prophet, right? I don't have the talents. Well, neither was Moses. What do you need to speak the word of God? Eloquence, right? Nope. That's not what you need. You can be slow of speech and slow of tongue and still be not only a prophet, but the greatest of the prophets, at least until Jesus, if you consider Jesus a prophet. maybe you just don't want to be a prophet, right? Maybe you sort of feel like, I'd rather be an investment banker. Well, that was Moses too.
How do you pay your seminary loans when you're a prophet?
That's a good question. Yeah. Good question.
I'm looking for the answer, though.
Oh, well, I can't answer that. I'm still paying mine back. In fact, I just started. No, it wasn't in seminary, but I was in divinity school. And it ended up, just by living in New Haven, Connecticut for 2 years, that ended up costing me more than my other education combined. So there you have it. Don't live in Connecticut. There's some advice, practical advice for you. The point here, of course, is that all human beings are not equipped for this job, and that is biblical. It has to come from God. And so I sort of feel like there's a bit of a cop-out if we think that we can't be prophets. In a way, it's like saying, I don't believe God can be involved in my life. Don't worry, nobody's going to put you in the Bible. Okay, that canon is closed, at least for now. But I think you can be called into a kind of prophetic perspective, and I think that's one of the things that Brueggemann can show us. I think it's also something we can see in a certain set of American writers that write in a particular way. This notion of prophecy. And one of the reasons I started with Steinbeck is actually not because of what he wrote and published, but because of something that was in one of his diaries, a diary that he kept when he was writing Grapes of Wrath, his great novel. I ran across this and I had not been able to forget it. It's so weird. Talk about a crackpot, Fred. Look at, I've actually written a couple of the entries on the board here, but you can also see them on one of your sheets where you've got a couple of references to Steinbeck as a prophet. And again, I don't know where this is coming from. I don't know if Steinbeck was drunk. Ego-tripping? Manic? I don't know. I can't explain it. What I can say is that there are certain words on a page somewhere in a diary that make me think that at least he considered being a kind of prophet as part of what he was up to in writing this novel. You can see them there, but he starts with this notion that it seems to be necessary to write things down, can't stop it. This idea that there was some kind of force behind this that was compelling him to write. One of the things that's important to recognize about this project, Grapes of Wrath, most of you I should probably mention, many of you have probably read it. Anybody read Grapes of Wrath? For those of you who haven't, it's a book about the Great Depression. More specifically, it's about how the effect of the Dust Bowl ended up chasing a whole lot of people who had been sort of grounded in sort of traditionally generation after generation on the same land, off to become migrant workers. And it follows one particular family, the Jode family, and a couple of their friends as they make a trek to California, which they think might be the promised land, and which turns out to be a much different sort of place. Hopefully that summary doesn't give too much away for those of you who want to read the book, because it's really worth reading. Steinbeck, in writing this, had actually already done some writing about this topic, not in the form of a novel. He had written several newspaper articles and journalistic pieces about these sorts of topics. And some of them, if you go back and look at those journalistic pieces, are actually showing up in the novel in slightly different forms. I've got a couple of those, and I'm going to put them out maybe in the library just because I don't want to break any copyright laws. But there's fair use, and so there's a couple of brief articles that you can take a look at in there, and I'll put one copy out, or maybe two I think I can get away with. For you to take a look at, partly because if you do read the novel, you're going to run into the same subject matter in a completely different form, fictionalized, in a way that I think is also illustrative about how different kinds of writing can convey different sorts of truth. So that's sort of the broad background of what Steinbeck's up to. But when he starts this project, when he's actually working on the novel, it comes out like this. I'm compelled to write. Something outside of me is forcing me to tell this story. As he's working his way through the novel, he goes by fits and starts. Some days he's able to write nonstop, some days he's not. Those of you who are writers maybe know what this is like. You don't feel the spirit, right, moving that morning. This was Steinbeck as well. Fairly late in the enterprise, in journal number 97, he says something which is really sort of remarkable, and this is where you just don't know. If he was drunk, why did he write it down? Right? Why keep it in a journal? Why not erase this? Well, it's in the journal. Tom Joad is a character in his novel. It's the oldest or second oldest son, but sort of the, in some ways, the heir of the Joad family. And he's an ex-con who's just got out of prison at the beginning of the book. And at a point late in the book, he's running into some trouble. right about this point in the novel, Steinbeck has this experience. Tom, he writes, it wasn't him. Yes, I think I can go on now. In fact, I feel stronger. Funny where the energy comes from. Strange, isn't it? He's seeing characters in his book in his room? This is very, very weird. I'm not trying to suggest that God was behind this project, okay? I wouldn't go that far. What I am suggesting is that somewhere in Steinbeck's mind at the time, he was up to something that's a little bit different than ordinarily we would think writing would be. He's thinking about writing in a different way here. And maybe he's crazy, but as Susan Briel reminded us in some of her Bible studies last week, crazy people are some of the people who are on the edge of where language is working. And they're a little like prophets like that. And actually, crazy people and prophets were two of the categories that Susan talked about as the people who are maybe able to open up new vistas of language and what language can do. So if you want to call Steinbeck crazy, okay, but maybe that's a necessity for a certain kind of writing. Maybe you have to be a little cracked in order to write something like The Grapes of Wrath. Maybe. Possibility. Again, this is something that's just stuck with me for so long that I've always kind of wanted to share it. The odd thing about this, too, is when you look at this point in the novel, there's a very famous passage in this novel where Tom is in danger and he has to leave his family. And his mother says, don't go. Anybody seen the movie? There's a sort of very melodramatic moment in the film, right? If you've ever seen Grapes of Wrath, where they have this almost word for word. In the novel, it's a little less melodramatic. But it's very interesting because Tom is talking about how he can be present. And he says this. His mother says, don't go. Where will I find you? And he says, then I'll be around in the dark. I'll be everywhere, everywhere you look. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Whenever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. And he's just separated his friend Jim Casey, who's a reverend, actually, a sort of heterodox at this point, kind of on the edge of the church in a way, has been killed. And he says, and Tom says, if Casey knowed, why, I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready, and when our folks eat the stuff they raise and live in the houses they build, why, I'll be there. See? God, I'm talking like Casey. Comes from thinking of him so much. Seems like I can see him sometimes. And what's weird about this to me is that, in a way, this is a sort of scene that's very famous in the novel that's almost a reproduction of his personal experience here, potentially, right? There's a sense in which the spirit of the ghost of Tom Joad, as Bruce Springsteen's album has it, the ghost of Tom Joad, was somehow inhabiting Steinbeck's experience, and he was really feeling that presence in his personal life, and that ends up showing up in the novel in the way that Tom says he's going to be around whenever there's social injustice and people fighting for their rights. Very, very strange, I think, correspondence between the personal life of Steinbeck and what he's doing in the novel. And at the end of this session, I want to come back and think a little bit about how maybe thinking about Grapes of Wrath, or at least parts of it as prophecy, may kind of help us open up some parts of the novel that otherwise might be closed. But the first thing I want to do, and again, today is I want to get a couple of ideas sort of out there that we can then use in future sessions in discussion. Part of what I want to get at is what seems to me to be most important about Walter Brueggemann's work for thinking about American literature and American writing. And I have sort of three propositions for you that you can reflect on as we go through this. One, I've sort of already alluded to. Theoretically, at least, any Christian, and maybe any non-Christian, can be prophetic. Can be prophetic, and that includes everybody in the room. Theoretically, it's possible. Second proposition. There are certain core characteristics of American culture that invite prophetic activity. Certain aspects of this particular country that invite prophetic activity. And the third proposition is that there are a number of American writers who constitute a kind of prophetic community, that they're already sort of showing us how what this might look like, and I think Steinbeck might be included among them. Okay, so keep that in the background, and let's think a little bit about those first two key terms that Brueggemann's going to use, prophetic and imagination. I put a couple of readings up on the board for you. If you want to read 10 pages of this book to get a sort of sense of what we're doing this day, you can look at this material here. If you want to read a little bit more, I would just read the whole first chapter, and maybe the preface that I'm alluding to. You could read the whole preface as well. The one other thing to read is the summary of Brueggemann's argument. It's awfully nice when an author writes a two-page summary of their entire book for you. This is in the book. Thank you, Walter Brueggemann. I actually have to do this for my dissertation later in the day. Mine's going to be 3 pages. But yeah, here it is, the whole summary in basically just a page, really. And then one extra paragraph that refers to the origins of Mosaic prophecy as being where Brueggemann's starting. So if you want a little nutshell of what that book is about, you can sort of see it right there in Brueggemann's own words, which is kind of nice. So you don't necessarily have to read the whole book to get a sense of the ideas. And I'm going to try to pull out the ones, not necessarily the most important ideas for Brueggemann's work in general, but the ones that I think are most important for thinking about literature. So the two key terms here for thinking about prophecy are prophetic and imagination. And we can just sort of split those up. Because in a way, they're not the typical meanings of these words for us. When I say prophetic or prophet, what do you think of? What sorts of associations do we have with this word, just sort of automatically?
Future,
mm-hmm. Right? Somebody who can predict the future. Others?
The ability to see, a seer.
A seer, yeah, yeah. Sort of see behind things, kind of a mystic knowledge, yeah?
Challenging the status quo.
Challenging the status quo. This is great, and this is starting to sound a little bit more like Brueggemann, but not necessarily. This is great, right? We think about these prophets like Amos, right? If you ever read the book of Amos, kind of, he's great. Angry. Angry prophets. Others? Other associations that you might have with this word?
This is sort of similar, but speaking truth to power.
Truth to power, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we hear that sort of language of social protest is also kind of a language of prophecy.
Ew.
Yeah?
Kind of wild.
Yes.
Image, you know, it's sort of uncontrolled. I mean, it gets into the establishment a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
But also, just wilderness. It depends. That's where it comes.
Right.
Right. Apart.
Yes, that sort of wilderness experience seems to be part of it. We can think about a character like John the Baptist coming out of the wilderness as a kind of New Testament prophet. Part of why I resist those sorts of definitions is because it makes it sound as if you have to stop combing your hair or bathing if you want to be a prophet, right? And actually, Joseph Blankenship has a quote here about the problem of the word prophet and how difficult it is for biblical scholars to kind of break through some of the notions that we have about prophecy. He says, the word can refer to prediction, right, future orientation, emotional preaching, right, that sort of, oh, I really feel it, and I feel in the spirit. Social activism, right? The ability to enlighten and communicate insight. Sort of idea this year. The founding of a new religion. It always starts with a prophet. Or the leadership of a cult group. And Blankenship says, none of these connotations corresponds exactly to the social reality of prophecy in biblical Israel. So part of what a scholar of the prophets is going to end up having to do is kind of break through some of our preconceived notions at least and kind of reformulate them, reorganize them for us. And this is one of the things that I think Brueggemann is doing as well. One of the most important things that he does with this word is make it an adjective. And again, these are the ones that are especially important for thinking about how this might be relevant to literature. Not prophet, but prophetic. Okay, what does that do to start thinking about prophetic as opposed to just prophet for you?
About the message rather than the person.
Okay, yeah, something about the character of the prophet. Other?
Describes action.
It can describe an action, right? You can have a prophetic action without necessarily thinking you have to inhabit this very peculiar, particular role with the wild hair and the eating of locusts and what have you, right? So turning it into an adjective is really significant. Now it can refer to activities. It can refer to ministries. He talks a lot about prophetic ministries as being something that the contemporary church is called to. Prophetic calling ends up starting to sound like something that's maybe wider than you thought before. And maybe most important, prophetic perspective, right? it could be a way of seeing as well, which we might be able to participate in a way that we might not think we could participate in what we see when we read the great prophets of the Bible. So it's an adjective. As a perspective, and this I guess I alluded to this a little bit already, it's also not bound to the ancient world. We often think of prophecy as sort of, if it's authentic, it's something that happened a long, long time ago. And that era is over. We don't have people in the desert anymore with wild hair, right, telling us to repent. Well, actually we do. Sometimes we see them on street corners, right, with the signs and that sort of thing, these modern day prophets. But basically that's kind of seen as something that's passé. Now, if we're thinking about it as a perspective, we can start thinking of it as something that we can adopt in the contemporary period, and I think that's really important for Brueggemann. A lot of his work is pushing forward. Even though he's talking about ancient texts, he's thinking about how it's relevant now to contemporary society. And finally, well, it's unlikely that the prophetic perspective is ever going to be a majority perspective. It doesn't necessarily have to be as rare as you might think. You could imagine a whole lot of people who might fit within the category of prophetic perspective. It doesn't seem to be quite as high a bar, even if it's still not the majority. Maybe it's something that more people could participate in. At least that's potentially the hope of what Walter Brueggemann is thinking about when he's thinking about something like a prophetic ministry. Okay, so that's one important aspect of prophetic. Another is that it's communitarian. One of the reasons I asked about prophet as opposed to prophetic before is there's a kind of individualistic sense in prophecy, right? One guy gets struck by one lightning bolt and has one word, and I am Amos, right? That's kind of how, at least, I think of what the prophets were like. That's actually not probably what prophets were like in ancient Israel, although there are exceptions, and Amos might have been one of them. Brueggemann draws on the work of another biblical scholar, Robert Wilson, who was actually my Old Testament teacher quite a while ago now, who talked a lot about prophetic communities, that what look like these singular voices in the Bible are often attached to actual communitarian settings, that they're speaking out of a context, a social context, and that's part of what their words are expressing as an actual reality on the ground. That's important for thinking about how we read prophets in the Bible. But it's also important for how we think about how we might participate in prophecy, because if you think it's one of these lonely tasks where it's just going to be you and the truth that you and God develop through some kind of vision quest, that's again, a really high bar. And it may not be necessary to set quite so high a bar on prophetic perspectives. And finally, the word of the prophet is always directed toward a social and political reality. Right? It's always addressed to a social context. And that's true in the Bible, too. That's one of the fun things about reading the Old Testament, is you kind of figure out what the scene was based on what's being said. That's also important, I think, for us, because often we think of prophecy as something that's kind of a religious thing. And that may, for us, depending on what our definition of religion means, may sort of separate that activity from the rest of the world. Right? We can speak in tongues in church and then go and watch football, that kind of thing. What if we're actually called in prophecy to not think about church, not think about just that religious reality, not think about those walls, and to think more about the broader world? All sorts of things that ordinarily wouldn't look religious start to become part of the picture. And that's part of what the communitarian aspects of prophetic for Brueggemann, I think, also can point us to. And then finally, and these are Brueggemann's words, prophecy is both critical and energizing. Critical and energizing, not one or the other. And this is one of the things I think we often do when we think about the sort of social protest aspects of prophecy, right? It's about a kind of critique of the status quo. Part of it is, for Brueggemann, but that's not all of it. It's also energizing. It also has a kind of positive agenda that goes further than that, just basic social critique. And those sorts of visions, and you can find them in the Bible, like there's all sorts of visions about wonderful futures in this prophecy, and that, I think, is also one of the places that we can start thinking about writing and the sort of writing that we find in great American writers as part of the picture. It's not just about sort of criticism of the scene, but it's also about imagining a new world. And this is where the second term that's important for Brueggemann comes in, which is imagination. Maybe as important as prophetic in some ways. What does he mean by imagination? I think the key word for thinking about what Brueggemann is getting at with imagination is this one, alternative. He has a wonderful line. Again, for Brueggemann, everything sort of goes back to Moses and the Exodus. You've got Moses with a word from the real God who's coming out of a pagan environment, an Egypt with all of its gods, with its slavery, with its civilization, and saying no to that reality. And he has a wonderful line about the gods of Egypt where he says, the gods of Egypt are the lords of order. The gods of Egypt are the lords of order. And I think that's a real insight into the way that he thinks about prophecy. It's not about, well, it is about founding a new religion. But the primary step is an imaginative one. And I think there's a way of thinking about imagination which is about a reordering. Why do you need imagination? It's the way that we reorder our experience. That's the leap, right? So for Brueggemann, imagination is sort of that key for how you could possibly create a vision of the world as it should be and could be, but isn't now. Okay. And imagination is the quality that's going to be required for that sort of task. This is why it's not just social criticism. I don't know if you guys ever get weary of social criticism. We are all social critics. We all see injustice in the world. But don't you get tired of it sometimes? I'm sorry. Maybe because I can probably speak as a liberal, though I hate labels like that. I sort of despise liberal agendas sometimes because for me they don't necessarily go anywhere. They feel sort of like dead ends. This is bad. Yes. Now what? Right? So part of what Brueggemann is interested in this concept of imagination is that we can get beyond that sort of dead end of social criticism that just sort of points out injustice and then says, eh, not quite sure what to do with it, to create a kind of imaginative possibility for a new world that could be created out of that recognition of how bad the old world is. Okay, that's one of the reasons why imagination is so important to him. And for that reason, he talks about this notion of a prophetic imagination is neither fully liberal nor fully conservative. It's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of both. Part of what has to get reimagined is the old traditions. Right? All those old contexts have to get somehow reimagined in order to have relevance to today's situation. And he believes deeply in the Bible. He's not one of these guys who's going to say, chuck it out. Look at all the bad passages in the Old Testament. Just throw them away. No, he's going to say that's a cop-out. What we need to do is have the kind of imaginative perspective where we can rework those traditions in ways that'll work for us now. So this is part of what he's getting at. And finally, that alternative is going to be one that's an alternative to the status quo, which is, I think you used that term, right? The status quo, that sort of stagnant state of the world as it is, which sometimes tricks us into thinking that this is just how things actually are. One of the great benefits of being able to call on a God who is both in the world and also beyond the world is to say that that isn't necessarily the case. What looks like reality isn't reality. It's not God's reality. And one of the jobs of the prophet is to be able to get us from a place where we think that the status quo is the way things are always going to be, into a recognition of the ways that the status quo actually doesn't express reality. Doesn't tell us who we are, where we belong, what sort of society we can create. All of that is involved in Brueggemann's notion of prophecy. And I think it's also one of the things that we can start to see coming out in the sorts of stories that we find, both in the Bible and also in American literature. And if you think about this, one of the ways to test this is to think a little bit about Moses. Again, Moses is the central character for Brueggemann. And in that passage, you can see there on the little summary sheet that I gave you, I added one little section from page 6, which talks a little bit about Israel. And the idea that it is a new social reality that comes out of this sort of mosaic moment where there is a new community created, which nobody could have foreseen before, that it's brand new. Prophecy is born precisely at that moment when the emergence of social political reality is so radical and inexplicable that it has nothing less than a theological cause. Okay? Only God could have created the Hebrew people out of the slaves who were in Egypt through the word of a prophet like Moses. And you can start to see this if you start thinking about where Moses' biography sort of fits in our imagination. I like to just do a sort of test of this. If you're going to think about the sorts of stories that you think of when you think of the Moses story or the Moses biography, what do we remember about this character? Moses.
Basket.
Wait. What, say a little bit more just in case some of us don't remember. Basket? Great, okay. Everybody remember that one? We do, right? It's a wonderful story. Other stories of Moses' life?
He murdered someone.
Yeah, we've got the story of him murdering an overseer.
Raised by the Pharaoh's daughter.
Raised by the Pharaoh's daughter.
And his mother.
By Pharaoh. I always forget how to spell Pharaoh. Okay. Pharaoh, whatever. Raised by Pharaoh's daughter and his mother in secret, right?
Sort of before baby in the basket, maybe saved by creative women.
Huh. Yeah, they had a plan, right?
I mean, this, well, women that outsmarted Pharaoh.
Okay, so we've got the Hebrew midwives, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Would that be the designation that I could use for this? Midwives. These are such great stories, aren't they? Moses' life is just filled with these wonderful stories.
The story of the Ten Commandments, where it goes up and up.
Okay, we've got the Ten Commandments.
Moses and the burning bush.
Burning bush, yes. Burning bush.
Before that, exile.
Yes, exile. Doesn't he actually name his son? Doesn't Moses name his son? It's like the Hebrew word for alien, I think? Something like that? Yeah, there's an experience of exile because he murders this overseer and he's afraid he's going to get caught, so he runs off. Yeah?
Reluctance.
Is there a story?
Having your brother speak for you.
What's that? Okay.
Having your brother speak for you because he just came. I don't know how you
did that. Yeah, he's got this character of sort of reluctance. Some of that is sort of coming through here. But this is the experience when God is telling him he needs to go and send the message, and he sort of says, no way. I can't do it.
Pharaoh and bringing down the plagues.
Okay, the plagues.
Exodus.
Exodus. What's the big story here?
Parting of the Red Sea.
Yeah, right? These are just great stories. The parting of the Red Sea.
He does not reach the promised land.
Yeah.
And he doesn't reach the promised land, yeah. Doesn't get there.
Doesn't he ask God to change God's mind about punishing the people after they set up a golden calf?
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember sort of the context of that statement. Golden calf we certainly can put in, and maybe we can put this with the Ten Commandments, because that wonderful shattering moment. Golden calf. Intercession.
He does argue with God when the people are making him crazy with all of their petty little terms and wants.
Right.
These people that you stuck me with.
Just send them back to Egypt.
He's
right?
the one who
they
says,
want to go anyway.
He's the one who says, God, if you kill them now, what will people think of you?
Yes.
That you brought these people out to slaughter them.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't believe
so that's
the
story.
The Passover, okay, so involved in the plagues, we also have the real kicker, right? Passover.
Manna and water from a rock.
Water from a rock. Okay, this is one of the desert miracles here somewhere. Water from a rock. I can't remember if it fits here or not. But there are a series of desert miracles, right? Water from a rock. Anybody noticing anything that sort of ties all these stories together? They're memorable, first of all, right? Everybody remembers these little tidbits. They're wonderful, wonderful little narratives. Anything jumping out at you as one of the things that could maybe connect these as stories?
Crackpot?
Crackpot?
Just cooks.
Yeah, he's a little bit of a crackpot.
Imagination?
Imagination, yeah.
I mean,
how so?
All of those stories are just so fantastic, so unusual.
Okay.
And that takes imagination.
Yeah, yeah. There's a kind of imagination at work even in the telling of these stories. One of the things that maybe makes them... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, he's only the vessel.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's not about him.
Yeah.
It's just that's...
No, I think that's really important. These Moses stories are not so much about Moses, but about God, right? What kind of God, yeah?
His family and kingdom shows up a lot from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. But I was also thinking, you haven't really mentioned Sister Miriam, but...
No, right.
Right at the beginning with the baby in the basket, she's there, but also singing, you know, after the river.
Mm, yes, Miriam's, yes,
yeah.
Yes, right. So Miriam is kind of in the background here too.
Just family and community being central.
One of the things that we can notice about all of these stories too, and this has to do with why they're imaginative, and I think also why they're striking to us, is they're all subversive. They're all subversive. Hebrews midwives, what are they doing? Tricking Pharaoh. What's that?
Disobeying imperial law.
Yeah, they're disobeying the law. They're criminals. They're outsmarting Pharaoh. That's why we like the story. I actually collect crime stories on DVD. There are so many American crime stories. We sympathize with criminals for some reason. I think it's because they're interesting, right? This was Milton's great problem. Satan is more interesting than God in Paradise Lost. Isn't that Milton's fault? I know he's a wonderful poet, but it's the kind of God that you see in that. It seems to be a God of mostly order, maybe? Okay, we don't want to necessarily go that far. But one of the things that we see in Moses is somebody who always seems to be subverting the order of things. Even before he's born, his story is about breaking the law, right? Baby in the basket, again, part of the same story. Raised by Pharaoh's daughter, ethnicity, right? This prohibition against the Hebrews specifically is being undermined within Pharaoh's own house. What a great story. Murders an overseer, even to go that far. This one who's raised as an Egyptian comes out and kills for the sake of his Hebrew brothers who then threaten to turn him in, right? Isn't that kind of how it goes? They're very subversive stories. Exile, the burning bush, the sort of subversion of even the order of nature. We see it in the plagues, right? The subversion of the idea that Pharaoh was going to have a line that would last forever because he's basically a god. Nope. Nope. Parting of the Red Sea, the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments start to look like orders until you see them compared to the golden calf. And then they start to look pretty radical, right? Actually, a sort of radical new way of living. So part of what makes these stories, I think, interesting to us is because they're so subversive. And these are also the stories of the prophet who is going to be the prophet that all prophets are compared to from now on. So from this point forward, how do you become a prophet of the status quo? Is it possible? Or is part of what the idea that we're going to look for a prophet like Moses from now on to see whether or not they're true or false have to do partly with this notion of the ability, let's not say subvert, let's say reimagine or imaginatively reorder a social situation? Maybe this can also work through something like a story. And I do really think there is something to the fact that these stories are so interesting to us as stories, is because they're partly subversive. We can, I think, yeah, go ahead, please. Jump in.
A bunch of my parishioners have been reading The Shack, which has become a very popular book. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was written out here in the Cascades. And part of the reordering is, I don't want to give the story away. Has anybody else read it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a bunch of people have read it.
Okay.
But how the writer, or how the person in the story experiences God in a completely new and different way. Mm. or actually the Trinity, which I think part of the reason why it's become so well-read is it upsets people. There's been a lot of criticism of how he writes about the Trinity, how he experiences the Trinity.
Interesting.
It's kind of a reordering of how we think about our relationship with God.
Yeah. Well, and again, it may be, and this is something that we were actually going to save for later, but here's a possibility. Let's not look so much at the content of a particular story, but let's think about that possibility of the reordering as being really important. Because what's the truth behind that, even if you don't necessarily agree with the ultimate theory of the Trinity that sort of comes out of this particular work? What's the truth that you might find there? And this is one of Brueggemann's key concepts as well.
The Spirit is moving.
The Spirit is moving, yeah. Brueggemann's way of talking about this is to say that we worship a God who is radically free. And the reason that he has to say that is because we're always trying to put God in a box. Always. It's half of what we do as human beings, and the other half, I guess, is religious people, right? We're always trying to put God in a box, figure out what God can and can't do. And one of the things that the prophetic voice does is remind us that's not the way it works. We don't get to decide where God is going. So even if some of these subversive stories come up with conclusions that we don't agree with, one of the things it can do is keep us on our toes, right? As opposed to set in our ways. That's important work. That's a significant truth. Now, that isn't to say that there's no value in tradition. But when tradition becomes a box for God, now you're in trouble. Now what you've got is a golden calf. And you're calling it God, and you're going to take it wherever you want. Because the Spirit doesn't move in that kind of situation. That's one of the dangers that's on the conservative side of the spectrum for Brueggemann. There are other dangers that are on the liberal side. The idea that you can't really imagine a new place if you're always just critiquing the status quo. That you can't see the value of a tradition as something that can be reimagined if you have that perspective. And the prophet is sort of in the middle. I want to have a chance, I'm going to talk a little bit tomorrow, I think, about the American scene. I was going to talk about that a little bit today, but we can do it tomorrow. Just as easily. I'd like to look a little bit at this turtle crossing the road, if you don't mind. It's chapter 3 of Grapes of Wrath. And see what you think of that. Has anybody get a chance to read this already?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, some of you did. Anybody not read it? At least a couple. Okay. Can somebody tell me how much time we have?
About 10 minutes.
Oh, good. Okay. You know what? Let's read it, because this is actually one of the kind of funny things about it. It's quite short. It's only basically 2 pages. Those of you who haven't read Grapes of Wrath, one of the very weird things that Steinbeck does is he writes these interchapters. So you've got the story of the Jobs, right, which I referred to in the summary statement of this novel, which is a really interesting story, and then he cuts it up. It's a really dumb idea in some ways. If you're trying to keep your reader engaged in a narrative, you don't stop in the middle and tell a story about a turtle that doesn't have anything to do with anything. But he does this. He makes these inner chapters where he tells these stories. One of the reasons I wanted to use them was partly because you can read them almost like short stories. They're sort of encapsulated. And so I don't have to give away the Grapes of Wrath in order to use this, as opposed to the narrative of the Jodes, where if I tell you why Tom was in trouble, then you might not read the book. We can read these separately, and I don't have to spoil the show for you. But they're also just really kind of interesting. And in some ways troubling, because I don't like all of them as much as others. And yet, this story is one that I'll bet, if you took a poll of all the people who had ever read Grapes of Wrath, one of the things they're going to remember is the turtle. Weird. Don't you think that's true, those of you who have read it? Right, you remember a lot about the Jodes, but the turtle seems to be something that a lot of people at least remember. And it's strange because it's boring. It's a really boring story. Let's read it, right? somebody want to read, maybe just take a paragraph?
Concrete highway was edged with a mat of tangled, broken, dry grass.
and the grass heads were heavy with oak beards to catch on a dog's coat, and fox tails to tangle in a horse's fetlocks, and clover burrs to fasten to sheep's wool. Sleeping life waiting to be spread and dispersed, every seed armed with an appliance of dispersal, twisting darts and parachutes for the wind, little spears and balls of tiny thorns, and all waiting for animals and for the wind, for a man's trousers cuff, for the hem of a woman's skirt, all passive but armed with appliances of activity, still, but each possessed of an amour of movement.
Amash, yeah. Mm-hmm. Somebody want to read the next one?
The sun lay on the grass and warmed it, and in the shade under the grass the insects moved. Ants and ant lions to set traps for them, grasshoppers to jump into the air and flick their yellow wings for a second, so bugs like little armadillos, plodding restlessly on many tender feet. And over the grass at the roadside a land turtle crawled, turning aside for nothing, dragging his high domed shell over the grass, his hard legs and yellow nailed feet threshed slowly through the grass, not really walking, but boosting and dragging his shell along. The barley beard slid off his shell, and the clover burrs fell on him and rolled to the ground. His horny beak was partly open, and his fierce, humorous eyes, under brows like fingernails, stared straight ahead. He came over the grass, leaving a beaten trail behind him, and the hill, which was the highway embankment, reared up ahead of him. For a moment, he stopped, his head held high. He blinked and looked up and down. At last, he started to climb the embankment. Front clawed feet reached forward but did not touch. The hind feet kicked his shell along and it scraped on the grass and on the gravel. As the embankment grew steeper and steeper, the more frantic were the efforts of the land turtle. Pushing hind legs strained and slipped, boosting the shell along, and the horny head protruded as far as the neck could stretch. Little by little, the shell slid up the embankment until at last the parapet cut straight across its line of march, the shoulder of the road, concrete wall 4 inches high. As though they worked independently, the hind legs pushed the shell against the wall, the head upraised and peered over the wall to the broad, smooth plain of cement. Now the hands, braced on top of the wall, strained and lifted, and the shell came slowly up and rested its front end on the wall. For a moment, the turtle rested. A red ant ran into the shell, into the soft skin inside the shell, and suddenly head and legs snapped in and the armored tail clamped in sideways. The red ant was crushed between body and legs, and one head of wild oats was clamped into the shell by a front leg. For a long moment, the turtle lay still, and then the neck crept out, and the old humorous, frowning eyes looked about, and the legs and tail came out. The back legs went to work, straining like elephant legs, and the shell tipped to an angle so that the front legs could not reach the level cement plane. But higher and higher, the hind legs boosted it, until at last the center of balance was reached, the front tipped down, the front legs scratched at the pavement, and it was up. But the head of wild oats was held by its stem round the front legs.
Now the going was easy, and all the legs worked, and the shell boosted along, waggling from side to side. A sedan driven by a 40-year-old woman approached. She saw the turtle and swung to the right, off the highway. The wheels screamed and a cloud of dust boiled up. Two wheels lifted for a moment and then settled. The car skidded back onto the road and went on, but more slowly. The turtle had jerked into its shell, and now it hurried on, for the highway was burning hot. And now a light truck approached, and as it came near, the driver saw the turtle and swerved to hit it. His front wheel struck the edge of the shell, flipped the turtle like a tiddlywink, spun it like a coin, and rolled it off the highway. The truck went back to its course along the right side. Lying on its back, the turtle was tight in its shell for a long time. But at last, its legs waved in the air, reaching for something to pull it over. Its front foot caught a piece of quartz, and little by little, the shell pulled over and flopped upright. The wild oat head fell out, and three of the spearhead seeds stuck in the ground. And as the turtle crawled on down the embankment, its shell dragged dirt over the seeds. The turtle entered a dust road and jerked itself along, drawing a wavy, shallow trench in the dust with its shell. The old humorous eyes looked ahead, and the horny beak opened a little. His yellow toenail slipped a fraction in the dust. Okay. Neat little story about a turtle maybe, but why in the world? Right? Why in the world? In some ways you could say, John Steinbeck, why waste our time with this story? out of left field about a turtle, told at the pace that a turtle moves. Yeah. Every step. Thanks for that, John. I didn't have anything better to do with 10 minutes. Yeah?
I'm wondering if it has to do anything with the seed that gets left and then he covers it with dirt, because it's all about the dust bowl and the seeds and how the earth was barren.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, if you've read the other chapters, you know this is about the dust bowl. So there's a seed that's planted by this turtle in a kind of unobtrusive way.
It's also a story about endurance and about hope.
Uh-huh.
And it has these great visuals. I mean, this turtle is described so well as all, you know, in all of the kind of monstrosity that the turtles embody, and yet we get inside its head in a way. We get to identify with it. We're rooting for it.
Yeah.
And then we've got this great image of the tiddlywink that goes spinning in the air, lands on its back, and somehow that turtle manages to get back around again.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a...
Yeah.
And so it's a hopeful story.
Yes, yes, I think so.
It's also about goodness and malevolence.
Hmm.
Yeah. There's compassion, there's also darkness, the evil. I'm gonna hit that shell.
That's what I'm shell.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, the two drivers at the end, yeah. Yeah, the one who almost flips her car over. Sounds like she almost became a tiddlywink, trying to dodge this animal on the road.
But you can relate to the dimensions of the characters in both of those. There is sort of this, you know, when you see something, you don't want to hit it, of course, but there's also this, what if I did, you know?
Yeah.
The tension of, you know, of the character.
It's what's terrible about driving cars. This happens. Anybody who's ever hit an animal, you know what that's like, right? Thud. It can be the smallest bird. Ugh. Yeah.
So are these the themes of the larger novel that show up in these little...
Well, maybe. Did you read it?
No, not yet.
Okay, well, ask somebody who read it. What do you guys think?
There's just a turtle that just wants to cross the road.
Yeah, yeah. The Joads just want to. They just want to live. They just want to live. And you would say, it's so hard, but it happens. He gets across. It is a hopeful story. Here's a question for you, and this puts it maybe back in Brueggemann's court. Where is power in this story?
Truck driver.
Truck driver?
The anatomy of the turtle,
his legs.
The legs and the shell that saved him from the length of the neck, the sensitivity of the heat.
Yeah.
How about the seed?
The seed. Is that the character that's most important?
The seed is what made him cross the road.
He doesn't make it across the road.
I think he does when he gets flipped over. I think he actually ends up, it sounds to me like he ends up on the other side. No, maybe it's up to us to decide. Go ahead.
I think the turtle is the vehicle from the seed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the chapter with the tenant, chapter 5.
Yes.
Describes the barren soil that the cotton's not growing in. I saw this image that was very vivid. The toes working, the children were standing there with the toes working. And there was an image, this is a little peripheral, but there was one of the images that you showed last week of the man with his son. And if you look very closely at his bare feet, there are toe images from where he works his toes in the dust.
Mm-hmm.
So here these seeds are being dropped and planted in the dust, very specifically. The dust is pulled over the seed. It's shell dragged dirt over the seed. So you wonder if those seeds are going to make it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to the last reading with this amazing abundance of gorgeous, healthy, fresh, beautiful fruit that that grows and grows and grows and grows, but then if there's no one to buy it, there's no one to harvest it, and in order to keep prices down, all the fruit is destroyed, so that, and the pigs, so that nobody can eat it. So this idea of this seed being potential, I guess pure potential is what I would call it.
Yeah. Well, and you're a science person, so you probably recognize that sort of power. And you don't even maybe want to call them mechanisms of nature,
sure,
but it is something like that. And if you look, go
ahead. There's also the power of the malevolent. To go back to that truck.
Uh-huh.
In the earlier chapter, quoted the monster.
Yes.
The bank.
The bank.
Human.
Yes.
Which then becomes the human in the son of Joe Davis, who's out there with his Caterpillar tractor, who's going to run over that house.
Yes.
Make his $3 a day.
Yes.
That house is going to come down.
Yes. Yes.
Just
yes.
Like the turtle.
Yeah. You've got that parallel between chapter 3 and 5 with the two machines. If you remember, you need to make the straight line is the reason for going through the dooryard. And then that little twitch, that malevolent twitch, which says, well, if I have to go a little off to knock over a house, that's part of the straight line too. Get the people out of the way. $2 a day. So the question of where power is in the story is actually sort of two questions, and it's the ones that Brueggemann is concerned with too. Where do we think power is?
Yeah.
Often. Even if we're liberal, good liberal critics, where do we think power is? It's in the machine, it's in the faceless bank, it's in the profit motive, it's in the organization of society, it's in a diesel engine. Right?
It's in what we create.
It's in what we create.
The road, the vehicles.
We think that.
Right. And the question for a prophet is to say, is that the only way to see the world? Does imagination help us to recognize the faultiness of the myth of the status quo, which is not reality?
The cedar and the bush.
Yeah. The cedar in the bush. So I think American literature can help us with this. It may be the case that for Steinbeck, God is not a Christian God. It may be that he's thinking about a kind of natural principle as being the thing which can challenge our understanding of what reality is. But I think sort of what we were talking about before, if we can start to recognize that the real truth is that we need to stay on our toes, because what we think is real and can't be changed actually is less static than it looks, then maybe we can start finding new kinds of words that are going to be able to get us and maybe God out of the boxes that we create for ourselves. That's the thought, anyway. And I think we probably can end there. Any last thoughts about what we read or some of the other pieces that you maybe got a chance to look at? Lucy, yeah?
I feel like I have all these comments because I won't be here to
talk. I know.
That's okay. But I just noticed one thing. It's very hard as a Christian not to read about what they're saying about the turtle in the second paragraph, how just the body of the turtle will not allow any of these things to catch on the shell, and they just fall off. It sounds like the seed that's scattered doesn't pick up.
Yeah. Yeah. We just read that, right?
That just, to me, that's what you're saying about everybody being a prophet. It seems like there's nothing in this creature that was made to catch any of the things from the first paragraph. And yet, in the very crawling and the nature of trying to get where he's trying to go, he's pulling things up into himself that he doesn't even notice. His body is responding, squishing the ant, you know,
that's,
doing that without
yeah.
even knowing it. And that, you know, that's one of those ways that we, you know, we belittle ourselves. We say, you know, I'm not made for that. I'm not able.
Yeah.
We don't even know the half of the story. The turtle doesn't know the half of the story. But the one word he keeps repeating is the humorous eyes. And I love that.
Yeah.
And it's this, you know, we surprise ourselves for, I don't know.
Old humorous eyes. Old humorous eyes, yeah.
I was thinking at the end of the Bible study when he was talking about Paul, you know, was Paul a vessel or was he? That does our self-understanding of who and what we are and what we're about have anything to do with how God actually uses us?
I hope not.
And so, you know.
That's wonderful. I think that's just such a good, because he could have told the story about a bird carrying a seed, and then it would be, in a way, you're right. I was totally wrong. It isn't necessarily a natural mechanism. right? This seed did not evolve to be carried by a turtle. That was not how it was going to work. And yet,
think about the vicious power of the truck driver, yeah. And if the truck driver actually flipped the turtle to the other side where the turtle wanted to go, uh-huh. This negative power is turning into something positive.
By planting a seed. Yeah, interesting.
I think that's why prophets seek out the wilderness. I mean, I think that's why people come to a place like this. You know, yesterday, you don't have to go very far to get away where you can't see anything that we've created. And that reminds us of who created us and inspires. You know, because we get so caught up with our own creation.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I sometimes struggle with what it is that we get here, and maybe this isn't right to be. Do you know how much diesel it takes to get people here? You know, to celebrate, you know, Garbo? I mean, there are things about Holden that are always kind of, you know, they make you ask questions like this, but there's something to that. There's something about this that's open still, and it forces maybe us to be open in a way too, to be in this kind of place. I hope that's true.
I'm kind of wondering why you were hesitant in the beginning to say God was behind John Steinbeck's writing.
He drank. I have no idea whether that was part of the issue.
He didn't claim that.
Yeah.
Is that why you were hesitant?
What's that?
Because Steinbeck didn't really claim that, so is that why you...
No, I don't think he would have said that, but boy, there's something, it's definitely mystical, and I can never figure out why it survives. You know, there's something so...
So why can't you say God's
that God's behind
really,
it.
Yeah.
I don't know. No. I mean, it's not just that. I guess it's my reluctance to sort of try to claim somebody who wouldn't claim it for himself, that he's fulfilling the role of a prophet. That isn't necessarily my job to sort of say who is and who isn't. I will say I think that God could have been involved. And I will defend that.
Perhaps to bring God involved.
To say that he... But I sort of feel like the other way. Like, I have to sort of just say, if God was there, wonderful. If he wasn't there, in that particular statement, in that sense that Steinbeck had that night, okay. If Steinbeck was mistaken, prophets can be mistaken about the visions that they see, I think, especially if we're going to include all of us in this, right? So I don't know. God is everywhere, right? Whether there was a specific moment of special revelation happening in that cabin where he was writing, then I guess I just don't know about that.
Isn't that part of what would be part of art? If we are to have some sort of prophetic imagination, is to be able to point and say, look at this, there's something going on. Mm-hmm. There's something going on here. Mm-hmm. Whether or not he wanted to claim it a certain way, there's truth here. Mm-hmm.
How do you point? I think that's right. But then there's the question of how much do you say about this thing? Because I sort of feel like this is the danger that religious people have when they start with prophecy, which is all about destabilizing a certain order of things, and then naming things. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, here's special revelation, here's general revelation. Here's God doing this, and this is how God works, and this is this particular thing. And we set up the category and we set up the definitions. And for me, at least, partly because I have this sort of compulsion to organize in order to make myself feel safe, with religion too, that's one of the things that I have to resist, I think, a little bit in myself. Because I want to say, no, not that way, but this way. And I don't know if that's my job as much as trying to resist that and saying, if God wants to do it, he'll do it. At least that's for me. And it's a personal thing. It's more about my personality, I guess, and what my own demon is, I think, partly at least a demon of organization. That's a way to feel safe. Yeah?
Just one last. I have a friend, and when we're arguing these things about, she just shrugs and says, God is big. And then we just go on our steps.
Yeah.
Wait, because that covers it all.
Yeah. That's great. Well, thank you very much. I suppose we should eat lunch.
Thanks.